DW Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. I'm Jessie Wingard in Bonn, Germany. On the show, are human hands undergoing evolutionary change? The days for Chicago's rats are numbered. Researchers are trialling a new way to kill the rodents. And we head to an elephant cemetery in a rather unlikely place. All that and more coming up on this jam-packed edition of Spectrum. The city of Chicago is struggling with a growing rodent problem. Apart from using regular vermin pesticides, the city's Bureau of Rodent Control is trying something new – dry ice. Dry ice is carbon dioxide frozen solid. When it's put in isolated rodent burrows and then evaporates, the rodents suffocate and die. The first trials have been, for want of a better word, promising. Laura Posmer went to find out more.
Rats are a problem in every big city, and Chicago is no exception. In fact, the city has been struggling with more rats this year because of last season's mild winter. Once rats appear in a neighborhood, they quickly multiply, causing public health concerns as they can spread disease to humans. In the past, Chicago's Special Bureau of Rodent Control has fought the vermin problem with toxins, usually with poison which the rats eat. This causes them to bleed to death within a couple of days. But this autumn, the city started a new experiment to rid the city of rodents, using dry ice. Josie Cruz is the deputy commissioner of Chicago's Bureau of Rodent Control.
We're doing it in the parks right now, because we're trying to keep it a little confined so we know where exactly we're placing this dry ice. So what we do is that this dry ice, we find it has to be used in burrows, which is where the rats are living. So what we do is that we will take the crew out there, and they will take a scoop of dry ice, and they will put it into the burrow, and they will also go on the other side of the other burrow, and because there's always an in and there's always an out, and they'll do the same thing there. And with that, the gas, once it starts to evaporate, it's carbon dioxide, which lets out, which will kill the rat in the burrow.
There were more than 36,000 rodent-related complaints submitted to the city in 2015. This year, it's closer to 50,000. But, says Cruz, it's impossible to say just how many rats are currently roaming the streets of Chicago.
We can't put a number on it, but we have to realize that every year is different. And one, we had a very mild winter, so that gives the rats a chance to breed more. And we need to work with the residents. I always tell them, and they think it's funny, but I always say the rats aren't there because they like the neighborhood. The rats are there because they're feeding on something. A rat will not stay there if they do not have a food source. So I think that's what we have to tackle there.
Putting a scoop of dry ice in a rat burrow to kill the rodents nesting inside seems quite simple. But why dry ice, and what is it exactly? I caught up with Greg Engel, professor of chemistry at the University of Chicago. He demonstrates how dry ice works using some simple tools.
I'm taking a balloon and putting a little bit of dry ice inside and not blowing up the balloon. It's deflated. So just dropping a few chunks of dry ice into the balloon, and then we'll tie it closed.
And then we'll see what you will do with that?
Exactly. Well, the balloon is still deflated. We'll just set this on the table here. And we can revisit that later in the discussion.
That's exciting.
In the meantime, the dry ice will slowly sublime, and the solid dry ice will turn into gaseous CO2, and that balloon will slowly inflate. And then at some point in about 25 or 30 minutes, it will explode and pop.
And here we have something making a very bubbly sound. You put dry ice in a mug here?
Yeah, this is just a cup of water, and I dropped in dry ice, and it is frothing, and you can hear the bubbling of the carbon dioxide coming off. It's a bit difficult to drink because you would not want to swallow the dry ice, but it will carbonate the water so that it tastes like soda. And it makes quite a show with the steam and the fog coming out of the glass. It looks like something out of a mad scientist movie.
Dry ice, as Professor Engel explains, is just solid carbon dioxide. The same way water turns solid when you freeze it at 0 degrees Celsius, this gas will turn into a solid at around minus 78 degrees Celsius.
usually people use it for the same thing that you would use regular ice for. It's just colder and lasts a little longer and makes less of a mess. So we're here in Chicago. If you want to order a official Chicago deep dish pizza, you can get one FedEx to you anywhere in the world, and it will typically be shipped with a little bit of dry ice. And the reason for that is you don't get a puddle when it's done, and it can keep it cold longer.
Pizza aside, Professor Engel is also excited about the city of Chicago using dry ice to fight the rodent problem. He says there is no need to worry about safety or environmental problems.
And the same way these little solid pieces that I put inside this balloon, which was uninflated a minute ago, is now about the size of a softball and will continue to grow. When you drop the dry ice into a burrow and then cover up the burrow, this dry ice will continue to sublime and form gas, and that gas will then fill the entire burrow, and it will suffocate the rats that are inside. In that regard, it's a clean and fast and relatively humane way to kill the rats, and apparently it's working quite well. The amount of CO2 that this releases is nothing compared to a car driving by on the street. And thus, you know, there's nothing left over. There's no toxin that you worry about. There's no cleanup. There's no special handling except perhaps a pair of winter gloves. Those are good for safety's sake.
Together with the fact that dry ice is not that expensive, it seems like the perfect way to get rid of rats. But Josie Cruz from the Bureau of Rodent Control underlines that using dry ice is not enough. Residents need to take responsibility and keep their block or neighborhood clean. And even then, all stops need to be pulled out to fight the rodents.
All it takes is for one yard, and the whole block will be having rats soon if you don't start working on it. You know, the majority of it has been working very well, and we're going to continue. But people need to understand that this is just a tool along with the rodenticide. It's not just something that we're going to stop putting rodenticide and we're going to do straight ice. You just can't do that.
Even though in this early test phase, dry ice appears to be working well to get rid of the rats, it is no miracle solution. As long as there is food for the rodents to feed on, they'll always be around. But dry ice definitely seems a more humane way of killing them. Laura Postma, DW, Chicago.
Technology gets blamed for many things, from causing obesity to a reduction in our ability to communicate with each other. But could it also be leading to evolutionary changes in how our bodies operate physically? Specifically, are our hands changing as a response to things like smartphones? Richard Murray's been investigating with some experts to lend him a hand.
Digging. Hunting. Breaking stones, all things human hands have evolved to be able to do, but all things which we don't really need them to do anymore. Nowadays, we're far more likely to be tapping and swiping a device that we're holding in our palm. So does that mean that our hands are likely to change in evolutionary terms? Now we don't have to build our own homes or hunt woolly mammoth for dinner. British author Darian Leader, who's written about the history and development of our hands, thinks so.
Hand use has changed enormously over the centuries, and historians have tracked the different ways that people have kept their hands busy. Today is obviously a crucial time in the history of the development of our hands, because we're using them in unprecedented ways. With the introduction of digital technology, we're spending a huge amount of time texting, tapping, swiping and scrolling, which means that we're using our hands in ways that we've never really used them before.
But Darian thinks it's not the first time we've seen a big biological shift to do with our hands.
We used to use our hands in order to swing from trees, something called brachiation. And when we became terrestrial rather than arboreal creatures, so when we no longer needed to use our hands to support our bodies against gravity, there's the question of what use the hand had. This hand that had always been used for a long time to keep us hanging and swinging from branches. One could argue that what happened here wasn't a natural evolution, but the sudden confrontation of the human being with the failure of their hands to have anything obvious to do. And it could be argued that that introduced a very strange new space into our evolutionary history. We suddenly had parts of the body that we didn't know what to do with.
Okay, so if we look at the hand, it's a very complicated piece of kit. We have here a joint.
Dr. Zaf Naki is a specialist hand surgeon working in Manchester in England. Using a model, he explains exactly how our hands have adapted to suit our environment.
There are a number of key grips that we have in the hand. In fact, there are five key grips. We have the power grip, which is when you clench your fist. We have the carry grip, and then that's when you're carrying a bag of shopping. And those are the fingers themselves all curling in and carrying that object.
So are these the kind of things that will be in use when we're dealing with technology?
Well, the power grip and the carry grip, probably not. But then we move on to the precision grips. Yeah. And they are all based around the thumb. And they are most definitely in use in technology. So the precision grips, we have tip to tip, which is a tip of the thumb going to the tip of the index finger. We have tip to side, which is the tip of the thumb going to the side of the index finger. And then we have tripod grip, which is between the tip of the thumb, index and middle fingers. And the sophisticated precision grips, which these are the ones that technology is utilising or exploiting because of the precision we have in our thumb and our index finger. The base of the thumb takes a huge amount of pressure, and this is one of the reasons why it is the commonest site for arthritis in the hand. But that's been present for centuries, and time will tell whether overuse of technology will also contribute to arthritis at the base of the thumb.
Dr. Naki says he's already dealing with patients having pain issues because of handheld devices.
Well, I've had the odd young gamer attend to see me with problems with their hand, and we've managed that simply by weaning them off their gaming time. They were gaming 10 to 12 hours a day, but simply trying to have a phase out, like any overuse, simple measures such as rest, anti-inflammatory medication and splintage in severe cases. I don't think there is any evidence for any long-term injury to part of the anatomy of the hand. It's like any other ache or pain from a repetitive use. Once you slow down the use, symptoms do tend to dissipate.
But what about the issue of evolution? Is the style of movement we have to use on smartphones changing how we use our hands elsewhere? Again, Darian Leader thinks it is.
When I was growing up, we'd ring a doorbell with our index finger, but today many young people will use their thumbs to ring a doorbell, just as the use of the hands in turning the pages of a book has now changed radically. People all over the world are noticing that our relation to phones and computers is changing the way that we use our hands in many other areas of life. The thumbs are now being used in a number of very new ways.
Though Dr. Naki's urging caution about jumping to conclusions.
Based on archaeological digs, we find really that the structure of the hand last changed 1.5 million years ago, and that was with the advent of the use of stone tools in the Paleolithic times. Now, if we put that in perspective, Homo sapiens, our current race, has been around for 200,000 years. And if we think about industrialization, 300 years, and technology like the computer, that's been around 40 years. So although it would be easy to consider that the hand has changed so quickly in such a short space of time, currently the evidence is not there to show such a change.
And Darian admits that the technological revolution we've seen in recent years could change all this again.
We don't know what the technology in 30 or 40 years is going to be. We don't know, for example, if it's going to have the same emphasis on the thumb that current technology has. So I think we have to wait and see. At the same time, the only thing I think we can say for sure is that all the attempts to make voice-activated technology, in other words, technology that does without the hands, are doomed to failure.
But whatever the future holds for our hands and their evolution, Dr. Zaf Naki says we should be in awe of what's at the end of our arms.
We have here the most complicated biomechanical tool known to us in existence. And if you think about your hand, the wonderful thing about it, the same tool can have a sophisticated touch and feel. It can be extremely powerful, yet be precise. And to coin the cliche, we've got man on the moon, but we've not been able to reproduce a tool like the hand so far.
This is Richard Murray for DW in Manchester, England.
You're listening to Spectrum with me, Jessie Wingard, on DW. On Twitter, you can find us at DW_SciTech or check us out online, dw.com/science. Still to come on the program.
It's capturing water from like sinks and bathtubs and treating it and then either reusing it for irrigation and or in the toilets.
Green infrastructure. Is this technology the way of the future? But first, Rome is renowned for its spectacular ancient ruins scattered throughout the city. Many of those ruins and artefacts date back to the founding of Rome about 2,500 years ago. But an even older treasure trove from the past lies below the city, one that scientists are hoping will get more attention. As Megan Williams reports, these mammoth remains shed an important light on the city's prehistoric history.
This is the bottom of the river, and then...
Scientist Federica Marano and I are standing in a sea of huge white bones, ribs, vertebrae, femurs, tibiae, spread out around us on a moon-like surface. Marana is a geologist with the Earth Science Department at the Sapienza University here in Rome. She's showing me around a place called the Poledrare di Cecanibbio. It's on the rolling countryside west of Rome and looks like a warehouse from the outside. Inside, though, it contains the biggest elephant graveyard in Europe. And not just any elephants, but giant 300,000-year-old ones, known as Palaeologzodon antiquus.
These elephants were very big, larger than the African elephants. The shoulder height is more than 3 meters and a half. The tusks are longer than 3 meters.
So it would be taller than the building we're standing in.
Yes, yes.
This is just one of 140 elephant graveyards throughout Rome. One is near the Colosseum, which for years archaeologists mistook as the bones of beasts killed during the cruel games held there. The Poledrara is just one of two sites that have been properly excavated. Work here began in 1985, but due to shortage of money, it was only recently opened to the public. The elephants arrived here in Italy 800,000 years ago from Africa and thrived during the same period as Neanderthals. Little blades and axes scattered throughout show they ate them.
We know this because around the bones of this carcass, of this skeleton, we found a lot of implements, and some bones were intentionally fractured for the meat and also for the bone marrow.
Poignant signs of human life lie here, too.
We found the small feet of baby.
Footprint?
Yes, a small tooth of a baby that we prove the presence of human beings here.
It's still debated whether prehistoric humans actually hunted the elephants or whether they simply ate them after they died. So we're standing looking at them now.
But in this case, there are no evidence of human. Probably they died trapped in the mud.
Head paleontologist here, Maria Rita Palombo, points at what look like fossilized tree stumps. They're the upright tibiae, or shin bones, still stuck to the very spot the elephants died.
Some elephants were trapped because elephants like to go into the mud, like in Africa today, during the summer, during the starvation period, to eat salts inside the ponds.
However they perished, it's a powerful experience to gaze upon the remains of these ancient giants all around you.
We would like that the people come in this site and know about the prehistory of Rome.
As an important reminder, says Federica Marana, that history in Rome dates back much further than ancient times. Megan Williams, DW Radio, Rome.
Just like an elephant, you shake the ground and bury me down.
In Denver, Colorado, a new housing community, partially funded by the US government, is proving that green infrastructure can be cost-effective. It's also helping to keep rent prices low in one of the most expensive cities in America. Hannah Lee Myers took a tour of the Mariposa District to get an up-close look at some of the most exciting bits of the community's unique sustainable architecture and technology.
132 North had fired callers state they were fighting one shot hurt.
The La Alma Lincoln Park neighborhood in Denver, Colorado, had a reputation for pollution, poverty, and crime. But today, things are quite different.
This is the D line to 30th and Downing. Stand clear. The doors are closing.
Using cutting-edge and case-study green infrastructure, this neighborhood has been transformed into an award-winning, affordable housing community, now called the Mariposa District. And that name, Mariposa, has symbolic meaning.
The term Mariposa, butterfly, in Spanish, I think speaks a lot to the unique designs that they've brought into this neighborhood.
That's Region 8 Administrator Rick Garcia from the U.S. government's Department of Housing and Urban Development. Garcia explains that Mariposa was built with significant federal aid, starting with pollution cleanup by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
On the site itself, the EPA was involved, I think, early on in a cleanup of the site. Obviously, this location being adjacent to railroad tracks that had been used for freight and repair of large train engines for a number of years, it was necessary to do the kind of cleanup that would be needed before we could actually have this area be made available for people to live in.
Once the cleanup and well over 100 meetings with the community were complete, the Denver Housing Authority set to work building one of the most sustainable neighborhoods in the United States. And I was about to get a tour of all the best parts.
This is Ryan Tobin.
Ryan, nice to meet you. Yeah. Pleasure.
My guide, Ryan Tobin, Director of Development for the Denver Housing Authority, has dedicated the last 10 years of his life to making Mariposa as eco-friendly as possible.
This building has everything from a geothermal, a heat pump HVAC system, solar PV on the roof, gray water reuse systems in place, through the other things I mentioned, which are high efficiency controls and operational equipment within the building. So ultimately what we could say on this building is that it takes half the energy that a building built to this current code at its time would have actually been able to put out there. So 50% energy reduction.
First, we visit a control room, housing Mariposa's case study gray water treatment system.
It's capturing water from like sinks and bathtubs and treating it and then either reusing it for irrigation and or into the toilets.
This control room also contains a part of Mariposa's geothermal system, a line of copper-colored pipes with handles and metal-numbered tags that pump water down into the ground, heating it up or cooling it down for domestic use.
Designated right away. Anyway, so underneath this grill, and this is another pilot program.
Outside, we walk over grates on the sidewalk that Tobin explains hold storm water during flooding, so the water can be treated before returning to the water system. What makes this storm water system unique is that it's built right into usable space, opposed to monopolizing large chunks of usable land.
Get us into one of the townhomes?
Absolutely, yeah, they should all be unlocked.
Okay.
Inside one of the apartments, Tobin shows me how something as simple as installing a special gray light switch by the front door that turns off the flow of electricity to most of the outlets in the home can make it easy for residents to use less energy.
So this gray switch turns off every gray outlet in this unit. So if you leave your TV on or your lamps on, this is that last check out the door. I turn it off, everything but my alarm clock goes off. And you can see all the gray outlets throughout, so your appliances that would pull just energy by being plugged in, you're able to turn 90% of that down with just the flip of a single switch on your way out the door.
Near the end of my visit to Mariposa, sitting in Colorado's only residential interactive stairwell, featuring artwork and even museum-like educational buttons up the railing.
And here's the button for the Yucatan parrot.
Denver Housing Authority Intergovernmental and Community Affairs Officer, Stella Madrid, spoke about how Mariposa is proving to its low-income residents that building a stairwell like this one that discourages them from using an elevator and using green design to lower carbon pollution and cut long-term living costs are all related issues.
It's educating the community and the families who come into these new communities that in the long run, it's for best for them, it's best for our community, it's best for the financial elements of it, and it's best for the environment.
With word getting out that green building technology has rapidly improved, individuals and businesses with a variety of motivations are expected to follow Mariposa's holistically sustainable example.
Hannah Lee Myers reporting there from Denver, Colorado. As Rwanda strives towards establishing a knowledge-based economy and achieving its Vision 2020 goals, fostering innovative IT-based short and medium enterprises is becoming critically important. KLab, or Knowledge Lab, is a unique open technology hub in Kigali, where graduates, entrepreneurs and innovators come to work on their ideas and projects to turn them into viable business models. Jesko Johansson headed along to KLab. His report is presented by Bruce Alaconia.
For Claudette Irere, taking a bus ride in Rwanda's capital Kigali has never been so easy. With a prepaid bus ticket from AirClerk, one can now flexibly travel around without having to buy a ticket. This idea was developed at KLab, an IT center in Kigali. It is the place where business leaders gather the country's young computer brains to come up with innovations such as the cashless bus ticket. Claudette Irere, who manages KLab, says more and more people in Rwanda's capital are now using this innovation invented by young Rwandan IT entrepreneurs.
It's one really tangible example of success stories of KLab. Why? Because Patrick and his friends, they simply came up with a simple idea, but that is so efficient.
This is KLab, a short form for Knowledge Lab. In other words, a knowledge laboratory for IT developers. It is where ideas for Rwanda's young computer industry come to life. KLab offers plenty of room for developers to try out their new inventions. Claudette Irere says Rwanda is making steadfast progress, but there is still room for improvement.
So if you look at the skills that people have, you know, I wouldn't say that it's where we would want them to be, but we're getting there.
She says she would like to see more digital solutions developed for everyday life. Rwanda is a landlocked country, which makes economic development a huge challenge. It hardly has any natural resources. It has posted stable economic growth rates of up to 8% annually. Rwanda regards digitization as its most important raw material. For Claudette Irere, the IT industry can be a way out of poverty if there is enough knowledge and skills.
ICT has the ability of, being exported and imported at a zero rate, Like, it's a zero KG. That's what they keep saying. At a zero rate, so there's no cost.
Rwanda regularly hosts fairs and meetings on digital worlds as it seeks to successfully implement its IT expertise. This particular meeting brought together investors, developers and retailers. President Paul Kagame has set Vision 2020, which aims to achieve a knowledge-based economy, among others. Claudette Irere and the young Rwandan IT entrepreneurs have about 4 years to turn that dream into a reality.
I would want to see more. I would want to see many more applications being produced and are relevant to our challenges. I would want to see them more engaged. I would want to see them more exposed. I would want to see them growing and selling their small ventures.
Bruce Alaconia presenting that report by Jesko Johansson. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Spectrum. Thanks to our technician, Erhard Burger, and thank you for tuning in. We'll be back next week with another packed edition of Spectrum. To keep up to date with all things happening in the science and technology world, check us out on Twitter at @DW_SciTech or online at dw.com/science. I'm Jessie Wingard. On Twitter, you can find me at Jessie Wingard, and I'd love to hear from you. From all of us here at DW, have a wonderful week ahead.